Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zaito, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading for you today in digest form, World Radio Magazine for December 2008. World Radio is published by Armand Noble, call N6WR. The editor is Nancy Cott. She spells that K-O-T-T. Her call is WZ8C. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any of these may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin today in World Radio Newsfront. Material compiled by Amateur Radio News, courtesy of the ARRL Letter and Newsline. Broadcast is soon to clear part of 40 meters. Amateur radio should soon have less interference to contend with on 40 meters if all goes as it's supposed to. In about 6 months' time, powerful shortwave broadcast stations are supposed to move away from 7.1 to 7.2 megahertz, as that spectrum fully reverts to the amateur service. By way of background, before 1938, there was an exclusive amateur allocation of 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz. But due to world unrest, that band parcel was taken away to accommodate propaganda broadcasting in the lead-up to World War II. It had been thought it would be returned to the amateur service afterward, but its use for broadcasting continued due to the Cold War. In fact, broadcasting increased the size of its primary allocation. While in some parts of the world, radio amateurs managed to retain 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz, only the bottom third was amateur exclusive, and the remainder was shared with shortwave broadcasters. So the International Amateur Radio Union mounted a campaign for the 40-meter band to be returned globally to the amateur service. Its case stated that such a change would ensure effective communication support, particularly in the event of natural disasters. The IARU pursued the issue at the World Radio Communications Conference in 2003. There, its work gained 7.1 to 7.2 megahertz worldwide for the amateur service. It also got an extra 100 kilohertz added on the exclusive allocation, while sharing between 7.2 and 7.3 megahertz continues. That particular interesting news came from WIA News through AR Newsline. 2008 U.S. Air Force Marathon and Amateur Radio. Amateur radio was a part of the action at a recent Ohio marathon as a team of 35 amateur radio operators from organizations from around the Dayton, Ohio area provided critical communications for the recent running of the United States Air Force Marathon. AMS, operating under the direction of Greene County Amateur Radio Emergency Service, provided an information channel between hydration stations, medical stations, and the United States Air Force Marathon staff. For the 12th year, this marathon was held at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Most of the radio systems were deployed late on Friday, the 19th of September, or very early on event day of the 20th of September. The primary repeater normally used for the event is owned by the Upper Valley Amateur Radio Club of Fairborn, Ohio. Due to the remnants of Hurricane Ike, it did not have commercial power, and battery backup had run out earlier in the week. To make it available for the marathon, the Fairborn group was able to obtain a generator to keep the machine in operation for the day. Over 500 routine and emergency messages were passed during the event. This year's United States Air Force Marathon supported over 7,500 military and civilian runners from around the world. Over 1,500 volunteers, including 35 hams, assisted with the event. We thank an amateur, KF4KWW, WS8B, and AR Newsline for the information. Now the nation of Lebanon is on the air. Amateur call F5TLN, Foxtrot 5, Tango Lima, November, will be in Lebanon until February of 2009. He will work mostly in single sideband and also some CW, Morse code operations, on all high-frequency bands. He says he will confirm the QSL cards after his return home and points out that Bureau QSLs will take some time. I guess the bottom line is to please be patient on this one. China's in the business of launching a hamsat. China is planning to launch its first-ever amateur radio satellite. Michael Chen, BD5RV/4, reports that he recently received an update from BA1DU on the progress of the amateur radio bird. Originally called CAS-1, this satellite is now known as XW-1. It will carry a beacon and three cross-band transponders into space, one for FM, another linear, and the last designed for digital operation. Plans call for it to be launched into a sun-synchronous orbit in June 2009 by a CZ-2Z rocket from the Toyan Satellite Launch Center in northern China. Thanks to ANS with Newsline. Folks, there's another bit of news that is really very pertinent to this World Radio magazine. It's not printed here, and I don't think it's probably in the rest of the matter of the magazine either, because it probably came after this magazine began to print. But there was a major announcement in publications of amateur material last week. World Radio Magazine has agreed to be purchased by CQ Publications. Most of you know that CQ is another major amateur radio magazine, along with QST, which is part of the ARRL. You'll see more about this or hear more about it in the near future. And as I turn the page from Newsfront, it reminds me that the editor's log, which is to follow, is done by Nancy Cott, WCHC. The announcement of the purchase by CQ Publications also commented to the fact that Nancy Cott would continue as the editor for World Radio Magazine. Well, we wish them well, and we thank Alma Noble for many, many years of great publication of interested material for amateur radio community. Let's do the editor's log now. Amateur radio is a solitary activity. Many of us are attracted to the hobby because it allows us to have interaction with like-minded people while affording a semi-reclusive atmosphere. However, radio clubs are an important part of ham radio. National clubs cater to special interests, be they political or acting as watchdogs for our frequencies and modes, or providing activities to promote particular modes, bands, or facilitating the connection of hams with shared backgrounds. Local clubs are the workhorses of the radio service. They provide a social opportunity to exchange ideas and brag about accomplishments that leave our non-ham friends with a look of, what's he talking about, on their faces. Who else but another amateur would understand the thrill of contacting that last state for your worked all states, or getting out on a homebrew radio that fits in an Altoid can and using a wire antenna? In addition to providing a haven to validify our obsession, radio clubs sponsor hamfest and swaps, hold radio classes, and give license exams. Without local clubs to do all this work and promote, amateur radio would be hard-pressed to continue growing. It's already an uphill challenge to attract new people to the radio service, and it is not getting any easier. D. Logan, called WNHEO, our recruitment and promotion columnist, suggested having an annual awards program to reward those hard-working clubs that go above and beyond in their recruitment of new amateurs and promotion of amateur radio. Although there is currently a public relations award presented to an individual, that's the ARRL McGann Award, we feel that no one in a club is really working alone, and the club as a whole should be honored for its own team efforts. The details will be featured in our January issue of World Radio, but I wanted to give you a heads up and sneak preview. The contest will run from 01 January 2009 through 31 December 2009, with the winners announced in May. Although I don't see it said here, that must be May of the following year, 2010. It continues that the plan is to present the awards at the Dayton Hamvention, and that's usually in the month of May. There will be several categories, including educational outreach, public displays, best youth-oriented activity, best promotional event, and others. World Radio has always been a strong supporter of local clubs, from running stories you send us about your activities to our club deal. Check that out on our webpage of www.wr6wr.com. Click on Quick Clubs link in the top right corner. So we are very proud and excited to be able to debut this award program. There are some great local clubs out there that are working very hard to promote amateur radio, and they deserve recognition. Stay tuned for more details and get ready for making 2009 the best year yet for your club. Of course, I can't let this editor's log end without putting in a plug for my favorite holiday, Straight Key Night, or as some people know it, New Year's Eve. It runs for 24 hours, 0 Zulu to 2400 Zulu, January 1, 2009, and it is the perfect way to ring in the new year. It isn't really a contest, although you can vote for best fist heard and most interesting cuso. Straight Key Night is more of a rag-chewing event, an opportunity to wish your fellow hams a happy new year and relax by sending Morse code at a generally slower pace than when using paddles or a keyboard. Jump in and join the fun, won't you? Most importantly, send in your logs, photos, and comments to the sponsor, the ARRL, American Radio Relay League, to remind them that Morse code is still alive and well. I hope to hear you on the air. 7388, Nancy Cott, call WZ8C. Nancy finishes off by saying thank you very much for caring enough to take the time to let us know how you feel. Please keep in touch either through our web page, which is www.wr6wy.com, or email me directly at Nancy, N-A-N-C-Y, at TIR.com, or even via editor at WR6WR. Nancy concludes by actually giving her U.S. Postal Service address. It's Nancy, call WZHC, a P.O. Box 807, Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-Y, Michigan, M-I, 48440. I'll go now to the first featured piece. It's titled A Bit of Radio Row in Brooklyn. There's a question mark there. The author is Brian R. Page, call N4TRB. New York City's famed Radio Row wasn't exactly before my time. I was just in the wrong place by 1,000 miles when I stumbled into the electronics hobby as a kid growing up in Florida in the early 1960s. Radio Row got its start very early in the 1920s as broadcast radio exploded as a consumer technology. It was centered in the blocks around Cortland and Greenwich streets on the lower west side of Manhattan. By the 1930s, Radio Row encompassed several entire city blocks with many specialty stores, their goods spilling out onto the sidewalk in fair weather. The illustration from Radio Craft, that was a magazine publication, a Hugh Grenzbach publication, hints at what Radio Row was like in its first heyday. It's safe to say that an entire generation of engineers were raised on Drenbach's magazines, not only Radiocraft, but also the likes of Science and Invention and Radio News. Likewise, many of that same generation, the engineers who developed electronic marvels in World War II, shopped the stores of Radio Row. World War II meant lean years for consumer electronics, and at least some of the Radio Row stores were able to stay in business only by doing repair work. Wartime shortages dried up the parts market, and virtually all manufacturing was centered on the war effort. Even radio amateurs donated their spare parts to Uncle Sam. However, once the war ended, Radio Row experienced its second heyday as war surplus equipment became available. Compounding this tidal wave of surplus equipment, electronic advances made possible by war research brought back the consumer market together with television, FM radio, hi-fi stereo, and manufactured amateur rigs. My favorite recollection of this second golden age of Radio Row, the one I missed by growing up on the beaches of Florida in the shadow of the early U.S. space program, was written by Walt Gazzeri and 2EEZ. Quoting here, imagine one city block which had Harrison Radio, Henry Radio, and 100 other ham radio stores, vendors, parts dealers, push carts filled with surplus ham gear as big as your refrigerator, etc., as far as the eye could see. And the block was always mopped with people buying, selling, trucks unloading boxes of new equipment. You'd have thought they were selling fresh hot bread to starving refugees. But it was all ham gear. That ends the quote. Radio Row came to a sudden and catastrophic end in the mid-1960s. In a development that still raises tempers in some quarters, the entire area was condemned by the city and taken over for the construction of the World Trade Center. Local civic associations fought for years, but in the end, the city and state prevailed. Dozens of family-owned businesses covering some 564 acres were demolished to make room for the towers. Construction started in 1966, and Radio Row was bulldozed into history. Or was it? Planning for a recent trip to New York City, I posted a query to a radio history email group asking about any historically noteworthy sites needing a visit from someone interested in radio history. In addition to the monument in Battery Park dedicated to the radio officers who gave their lives in the line of duty, Richard Dillman, W6AWO, suggested that I look up Leeds Radio Shop across the East River in Brooklyn. A little internet sleuthing turned up a web page that led to an email address. A quick communication confirmed that the store, in business since 1923, had Saturday hours. With visions of classic boat anchor rigs swimming in my head, I laid plans to visit. So, on a warm day in June, my wife and I took time out of our 30th wedding anniversary celebration in the Big Apple to journey via subway from Manhattan to Brooklyn and, as I hoped, back into time. Getting to Leeds via subway is really pretty simple. Just take the L line east from any of the connecting stations and exit at the Bedford Avenue station, the first station in Brooklyn. Once on street level, walk along North 7th Street, heading west, back toward Manhattan. Leeds is located nearly at the end of the street, almost all the way to the East River. The area is largely urban residential, reminding me of the fictional Sesame Street. And as we walked toward the river, I began to despair, as I could see nothing that looked at all like my distinguished Radio Row refugee. I was surprised when we finally spied the storefront. It was a minor thrill, even a vindication, to spot the tiny L-E-E-D-S sign over an open wooden door next to a graffiti-adorned garage. And there's a picture of that, folks, on page 7 of World Radio. Knocking on the door, I was greeted by Richard Matthews, proprietor. Nothing could have prepared me for what I found inside. I'm sure that today's Leeds bears little resemblance to the glass-fronted retail stores of Radio Row. But inside, it has no shortage of treasures. In truth, it is more a warehouse than a store, and thorough browsing amongst the floor-to-ceiling stacks of parts and components would be a Herculean task. Leeds is the kind of place you go when you know exactly what you need to find. Richard's selection is limited. It includes probably every component known to mankind that was available prior to 1980. And the focus really is on components, especially tubes, transformers, lots of miscellaneous hardware for tube rigs, and the usual supply of high wattage resistors. Unlike the original Radio Row stores, You won't find stacks of World War II surplus BC-348 receivers, and I doubt that you'll talk Richard out of his National 183D receiver that he won in an auction from Radio Free Europe. However, if you need a knob for your 183D, I'd wager that he has one somewhere in the labyrinth of this vestige of Radio Row. Now, for the listener, the actual front cover photograph is of this particular Leeds store. You'd have to see it to believe it. It's absolutely as the article describes. Stacks and stacks of boxes and things with very little surface showing of radio control panels, etc. But it must all be hidden in those magical boxes, huh? Well, head along now to the next piece, International Communications for All License Levels. The author here is Jefferson Jeff, a Bushman, called Kilo Echo 7 Quebec Oscar Sierra, KE7QOS. Having had my ticket only since the end of 07, I feel a bit presumptuous writing a how-to that will be read by a number of more senior, inexperienced amateurs. But without the clubs I belong to, a few or no members seem to be familiar with Echolink. As a technician, my communication has been limited to local contacts in simplex and somewhat less local contacts with the use of repeaters. But Echolink changed all that. With Echolink, the ham uses a computer with access to the Internet and makes phone, that's the voice contact, with people who could be as near as down your block and as far as, I guess as far away as the farthest point on the planet in which another amateur is working Echolink. Echolink uses what is called VOIP, Voice over Internet Protocol. VOIP is a method that is also used by services such as Skype and Vonage. But for members of the ham fraternity, VOIP is the means by which we use Echolink. That's actually two short words, Echolink, together, linked together, Echolink. I'm aware of IRLP, but not familiar with its usage, so this effort is limited to Echolink. The first thing to know is that it is easy to use. To get started, you go to their website, http://www.echolink.org. You will be asked to register on site, which will require an email address and an amateur call sign. After entering those two items, you will leave the site, and the program will verify your license. You will be sent an email when that is done, usually in a couple of days. After receiving your verification notification, return to the website and download the Echolink program. When you are done downloading the program, you click on it on your desktop to install it. When that process is complete, you are ready to start making contact, provided you have one or two additional pieces of equipment. It's just one piece of equipment if you use, as I do, a headset that has a microphone. That way, you have the audio speakers in your ear, and you can speak on a microphone. If you don't like using a headset, and you already have speakers on your computer, you'll need a microphone with a jack that will connect to your computer's sound card. Finally, well, you will need a microphone and speaker if you don't have any sound equipment already. Then you plug your equipment into your computer and double-click on the icon on your desktop, an antenna tower with red lines emanating from its top, and a program will come up. I usually go to the conference section so I can listen to whoever is on before jumping in. But if you know other people who use Echolink, you can search for their call sign and the computer will take you right to them. If they're not talking to someone else, you and or she will appear on each other's screens. That is, your call sign will appear on the screen. Echolink doesn't have pictures yet, and you can talk to each other. In the conferences, there are usually two or more people already talking, and you can listen for a while to see if they are discussing something you're interested in. Often, since your presence is seen on their screen, you will hear someone invite you to jump in and tell a bit about yourself. Without going into a lot more detail, I can tell you that as much as I enjoy making local contacts on my mobile and my handy talkie, Echolink gives me the chance to talk with and listen to the people that first generated my interest in ham radio when I was a kid, 14 million years ago. Okay, a slight exaggeration. I have spoken to folks in the Philippines, England, Scotland, New Zealand, Japan, Mexico, and Australia, and probably more countries that I don't recall from the early days when I wasn't making notes. Join me when you have a chance. Look for me, and let's have a chat when you don't feel like talking to someone quite on the other side of the planet. That suggestion is submitted by Jeff Bushman. It's called KE7QOS. He can be reached by email at, this is a little different, lowercase, jb720@cox.net. He's currently working on a book titled Mobile Wells, regarding investment in mobile homes. His writing has appeared in a variety of publications, including Women's Sports and Fitness and Woodman of the World magazine. He resides in Mesa, Arizona. Thanks a lot, Jefferson, or Jeff Bushman. Well, folks, when I read material from any one of the amateur radio magazines, I always try to focus somewhere along the way in the recording on stuff that's interesting to young people, kids programming, and so forth. Here's a piece titled, A Great Kids Contest. The author is Ralph H. Clark. Call NM5RC, November, Mike, 5, Romeo, Charlie. After the dismantling of the temporary contest station, several parents lingered to visit with Phil Shaw, KE5LZX, and thank him for his efforts. As Phil drove off, one mother stated she would like to adopt him. What a fitting tribute to the 16-year-old manager coordinator of the station that finished first in the 2008 Kids Roundup Contest multiple operator category. Getting 14 kids aged 7 through 16 on the air during the 6 hours the station operated was a significant accomplishment, especially when an attempt was made to have each kid make at least one contact on a repeater, IRLP, 6 meters, and the high-frequency bands. Another young man who pitched in as a microphone mentor for part of the operation was Kenneth Smith. Kenny's call was KE5LZY. The adult mentors, there were 5 of them, job turned out to be an easy one as they observed how patiently Phil and Kenneth worked with the kids to get them past Mike Fright and having them beg to be allowed to call CQ Kids Roundup again. The mentors' uniform observation was that the kids would not have responded nearly as well to us old folks as they did to Phil and Kenneth. Handouts covering mode characteristics and good on-the-air operating practices were used for one-on-one pre-operating mentoring. The kids then moved into the mode's observation chair before moving on to the mic chair. Follow-up reports showed the contest experience and handouts were being used by some of the licensed kids for their first solo ventures with local repeaters and IRLP. The annual Kids Roundup Contest in 2008 on May 31 through 1 June is sponsored by Anne Arundel Radio Club, Jr. and runs for 34 hours. More information is on the sponsor's website at www.ki3ds.org. The voice-only contest is for kids under 18 years of age. Kid operator categories include single, licensed, kid control operator using their own call sign, single licensed kid using someone else's call sign and a control operator, unlicensed kid using someone else's call sign and a control operator, and multiple kids, licensed or not, using a control operator. Remember, folks, if they're not licensed, they have to have a control operator present to monitor the proper operation of the amateur station. In addition to HF, high frequency, the contest allows VHF, UHF repeater, and IRLP, or Echolink contacts, which makes for a lot of activity, clear signals, and a chance for the kids to learn and develop good operating skills. The AARC Junior, that's the Anne Arundel County Junior Club, does a super job sponsoring and running this contest. Within 60 days, the top three stations in each state in each category receive certificates. The top three stations nationally in each category receive certificates. And the top station nationally in each category receives a plaque, AARCJR. Also sent each of our 14 kid operators their own certificate. My grandson, then 7 years old, participated in the 2007, earning first place in New Mexico and third place in the nation for the licensed kid with control operator category. When the certificates arrived, he initiated plans to share the fun in 2008 with his Cub Scout friend. After the contest station QSL cards were mailed with the same address stamped envelopes addressed to the kids who made the contact for all but the repeater contacts. As cards came back, parents reported their kids were thrilled to receive their reminder of this experience. The Cub Scouts in the group are recognized in their next PAC meetings when they received custom embroidered badges for their operation of a ham station. One rank advancement requirement, which is often hard for Cub Scouts to complete, is the visit to a radio station, TV station, or newspaper. Participation in the contest not only met the visit requirement, but also got them on the air. The 14 kid operators came to the drop-in event from a variety of places. A couple were from the Boy Scout troop, which had recently completed a technician licensing class. Some were from W8JME's Cub Scout pack. Some were attracted by a notice in a local homeschool newsletter. Several were brothers and sisters who tagged along, and a few were grandchildren dropping by with a ham grandparent. Of the 14, 5 were licensed, and a couple of them made their first contacts during the contest. The three YLs, that's young ladies, were the youngsters in the group, and each attracted a pileup when they called CQ. Happy with the success, the mentors' suggestions for drop-in multiple kid operator stations fell along the lines of having a young man or woman with Phil's patience and demeanor work with the kids at the microphone, careful planning, and active recruiting of kid operators. We would also suggest sending QSL cards to the repeater contacts. Other ideas include taking a picture of each operator and putting it on a QSL card for their contacts, giving each kid a copy of the picture for them operating or their customized QSL card, and having someone signed to get some good pictures of the overall operation. A substantial portion of the adult mentor's time was spent visiting with the 15 adult visitors about amateur radio, the various modes being used, and the terminology the kids were using. Having enough mentors to do this is essential. And don't forget snacks and drinks for both the kids, visitors, and mentors. Those helped occupy the adult visitors so the kids could spend more time learning and at the radios. While this multiple operator operation got 14 kids introduced to ham radio and on the air, working with any kid in one of the contest's single operator categories is a good way to get kids interested in amateur radio and or help them learn and practice good operating skills. We hope to visit with your contest station next year. Contacts with other kids are worth 10 points. But if that is not possible, please stop by for QSO so the kids can log 1 point for OMs, that's the old men, and 2 points for YLs, those lovely young ladies. If you're interested in more information about this particular commentary about the Great Kids Contest, you could contact Ralph Clark, C-L-A-R-K. His call is NM5RC, November Mike 5. Romeo Charlie, at his call sign, in lowercase, NM5RC, at ARRL.net. Let's take a look at letters to the editor. One here caught my attention right away. It's an acronym, QCWA. Quarter-Century Wireless Association column is a favorite. It goes on, Alan Pickering's lofty and inspiring column in a recent World Radio magazine prompted me to investigate what, QCWA is all about. I haven't any awareness of the organization other than its age requirement. I've been licensed since the mid-50s, so would qualify. I've enjoyed Alan's columns. He is a gifted writer. The thank you came in from Jerry Peterson, call K9BWE, Mount Prospect, Illinois. Another one here. Glad they have the lifetime subscription. Hello, guys. Just a word of thanks for such an informational publication. The World Radio Magazine has been so great to read that you have outdone QST. My wife, Myrna, KN7N, purchased a lifetime membership many years before we got married. That has been 13 and a half years ago, and World Radio is the first thing I read each month. I still have several QSTs unread. You have so much useful information, and I read it from cover to cover. I love to read Kurt's articles. He makes amateur radio so much easier to understand. Please keep up the good work. 73, Terry Cross, call NK7T, husband of Myrna Cross, KN7M, Mesa, Arizona. Looks like he's trying to score some brownie points there, folks, huh? Here's one about the International Space Station webpage. I put together a webpage about my ham radio contacts with Richard Garriott, a famous video game developer, who visited the International Space Station as a $31 million paying passenger, that's true, through Space Adventures. I am still adding information and links now that Richard has returned. I try to build pages to promote the ham radio and educational aspects of the International Space Station amateur radio activities. I try to use them to gain local and regional interest to see if we can inspire new ham radio operators, increase ARIS activities, and whatever. I'm a longtime ham since 1963, with interests from space to boat anchors, active as local radio club officer, Mars, 30 years plus, ARIS, Red Cross, Space Pack at SSTV, vintage gear restoration and operation, and on. I enjoy World Radio and have used it for years to help get new folks interested in ham radio. It's signed 73, Greg Greenwood, call WB6FCH, Weaverville, California. Here's another one. Jerry Boyd is irreplaceable. I enjoy World Radio each month and the refreshing other point of view it provides. I am very sorry to see Jerry Boyd and 7WR go. His column is one of the best parts of the magazine. While I believe what he has been telling is true and respect his reasons for not wanting to butt his head against a wall anymore, I shall miss him. I hope you will be able to get him to do a column or two in the future. Thanks for bringing him to my house each month. While a magazine and a column will no doubt continue, Jerry cannot ever be replaced. That was filed by Dave Lamb, L-A-M-B, W-6-D-E-L, Sun City West, Arizona. And there's an editor's note after that one. We are happy to tell you that Jerry will be around. He will continue to write occasional feature articles for World Radio. So there. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, folks. You know, as I look to the bottom of this particular page of the December 2008 World Radio, it's page 18. There's a photograph of a gentleman working, apparently, a computer, a ham station, and other equipment. It says, Hams with National Guard. Ken Johnson. His amateur call, KS5R, Kilo Sierra 5, Romeo. Slant Alpha Alpha Mike 6, Romeo Delta. That's the Army Mars call. From Houston, Texas, mans the multi-mode operating position of an Army Mars deployment team supporting the Texas National Guard at Columbus, Texas. The group is one of four providing HF voice and wind link support to Texas Guard refueling units. These were stationed along major routes used by the fleets of buses carrying evacuees from Hurricane Gustav. Johnson, who is Deputy Director of Army Mars Region 6, which includes New Orleans, is pictured aboard the W5DSC emergency van of the Victoria, Texas Amateur Radio Club along Interstate 10, west of Houston. A 5th Army Mars team was positioned at the State Mobile Command Post in Bryan. The photograph was submitted by John Wagner, WA5BP, slant AAR6CC. We thank all these fine people for the use of their time, equipment, and ingenuity to serve the public in times of serious disasters and other needs. You know, having just talked about emergency communications, folks, there is an article here, Products for Emergency Communicators. The author is Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR. It's in the section of the magazine, Emergency Communications. Once in a while, a book comes along that causes me to take a hard look at my emergency response attitudes and how I might respond. I've formed many opinions as the result of being involved with various events, but I also confine my behavior based on too few facts or not enough experience and make adjustments as I learn. I came across one book that is now at the top of my list for every emergency services person. The book, authored by Amanda Ripley, is entitled The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and Why? You can order it online for about $20, and I guarantee it will change your perspectives on emergency response. Amanda is a writer for Time magazine and spent considerable time researching emergency events and interviewing survivors. She has also looked at what research is available concerning emergency response and human behavior during emergencies. In short, her work is outstanding. After reading this book, you will never sit at your desk when the office fire alarm sounds. A friend who is reading the book upon my recommendation reported that he and his wife immediately left their hotel room when the alarm sounded, and he observed the complete indifference shown by others. His behavior has changed, and he's still studying the book. When you read this book, you will discover why you never ignore fire alarms in buildings. If you read the book, you will discover why reading the aircraft evacuation cards is important. You will learn why information is so critical during stressful and emergency situations. You will discover why it is so important to impart accurate information in a timely manner. You will discover why some people freeze in an emergency and why others act quickly. You will come to better understand why people do not leave when hurricane warnings are posted. As you read this book, you will consider what you might do in an emergency and how you might be better ready to react and save lives. You will learn why panic seldom happens to a group, and you will understand exactly what panic is and how it is caused. Don't pass by on reading this book. Again, the title for that book is The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. The author, Amanda Ripley, R-I-P-L-E-Y. There's more in the article. I'll continue with looking good. How we look to others, especially law enforcement, is always a touchy subject. Some of you have desires to just dress in nice looking and whether appropriate work clothes, and perhaps have a shirt or jacket that identifies you as an amateur radio operator or your affiliation with a group. I personally like a yellow vest with emergency radio communications on it. This I ordered from a Nevada embroidery company after I saw one at a Reno amateur radio event. You might also have a simple photo ID card clipped to your pocket that shows you're a member of, in good standing of your radio group. There are others of you who desire to come very close to looking like a police officer, complete with badge, web belt and gear, pressed uniform shirts, and such non-radio gear as handcuffs and nightsticks. It is a sensitive topic, and when I have mentioned it in the past, your comments are passionate for and against badges and formal uniforms. The best argument for a formal badged uniform is that your sponsoring agency has developed and approved it. Some groups are sponsored by a police agency and often do more than just radio support. Great, go for it. When you have official agency endorsements and a close working relationship, there is seldom a problem, as you are a recognized recourse. Consider, however, showing up at an event for an agency that doesn't normally request your group, and you have badges, police-type belts, formal uniforms, and vehicles lit with other-than-yellow lights. What's their reaction? If you look more official than they do, they're going to be threatened because people at the scene might think you're in charge. People might come to you for official information. In short, you don't make too many friends among the agency officers when you're there to do radio support only. Be careful. Do not offend the agency you serve. Ask in advance. Get clarification in advance. One officer explained that badges, belts, and marked vehicles are not all against the law. Many security companies are so adorned every day as part of their business. But, he said, when you are at a scene of an emergency and your role is providing communications, you risk impersonating an officer because of the situation. Where all elements come together to give the impression that you are what you are not. If you are there to provide communications, be sure you are invited to the party and have dressed appropriately. You don't want to offend your host to the point your dance card is forever revoked. Check with the host in advance if you have concerns and questions. If this is your first encounter, be conservative in your appearance. Until next month, best wishes from Salt Lake City. Signed, Jerry Wellman, call W7SAR. Jerry can be reached by sending mail to P.O. Box 11445, that's 11445, Salt Lake City, Utah, UT, 84147, or by email to, lowercase, initials only, JW, at DESNEWS.com. That's JW at DesNews.com. Here's a bit of interesting news from 1010 International. The 2008 1010 election results. The article here is submitted by Gerald F. Gross, called WA6POZ. The 2008 election results are in. We were very fortunate to have a slate of very qualified candidates for the office of vice president and four directors. The newly elected board members are Vice President Larry Berger, call WA2SUH, 1010 number 407. Director Mel Sojka, S-O-J-K-A, call KD5DE, 1010 number 33513. Director Robert Farrow, F-A-R-R-O-W. Bob's call is N6OPR. His 1010 number, 69811. Director, Rob Ireland, VE9KM. His 1010 number, 15675. And for director as well, Leslie Johnson, WA4EEZ. I do not have her 1010 number here. The newly elected board members will take office on 01 January 2009. Their term of office is 2 years for vice president and 4 years for director. Another thank you to Jack Moore, K5CC, 1010 number 50708, who served as a chief election teller. Also, thanks go to members that took the time to cast a ballot. It is always nice to see the members getting involved in their organization. In the year 2010, 1010 will be electing a president and four directors for the term beginning in 2011. Consider stepping forward to lend your time, knowledge, and personal expertise to your organization. 1010 International Net Incorporated. 2009 is a convention year for 1010. Orlando, Florida, from 24 July 09 to 26 July, will be the site of the 1010 biannual convention. Hosted by the Cypress Chapter, the convention chairs are Floyd Lark, KK3K, and Charles Hennessy, AF4QT. The event is beginning to shape up to be another memorable gathering. It will be held at the Holiday Inn Select in Orlando, Florida. The convention will be the place in 2009 to meet with the many friends that we have exchanged contacts with over the years. Planned events include chapter tables with over 30 chapters agreeing to participate, forums on paper chasing, planning a 1010 convention, 1010 organization update, and other features are in the works as well. Visitors will be able to visit Universal City Walk, where they can shop and eat in one of the prime tourist attractions in Florida. The hotel convention rate will be available for 3 days before and after the convention. Reservations and more information will be available on the 1010 website after 01 January 2009 and the January 1010 news. Convention setup and the annual 1010 board meetings will be held on Thursday, 23 July 2009. We have a couple of special events to announce for December. Christmas from Bethlehem, that's actually Belen, New Mexico. Valencia County Amateur Radio Association will operate special event station KC5OUR to celebrate Christmas from Bethlehem, Belen, New Mexico. The station will be on the air 18 through 23 December 2008 on various frequencies. For a special, beautifully designed QSL card, send the same address stamped envelope with your QSL to VZARA, P.O. Box 268, Peralta, P-E-R-A-L-T-A, New Mexico, N.M., 87042. Now, Pearl Harbor Day, the Baton Rouge Amateur Radio Club and the USS Kidd Amateur Radio Club will operate special event station W5KID on the USS Kidd in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on 7 December 2008 to commemorate Veterans Day and the anniversary of the death of Rear Admiral Isaac Campbell Kidd, Sr., killed while aboard his flagship USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. They will be on the air 9 a.m. to 4:45 p.m. Central Time. Time may be extended depending on the visiting schedule for the ship. They're on single sideband frequencies inside the general band and above the RTTY subband. Also on QRP and CW frequencies. So, if you're scanning the bands, listen up for the Baton Rouge Amateur Radio Club and USS Kidd Amateur Radio Service. The 75th anniversary of FM radio, Major Edwin H. Armstrong Memorial Radio Club, will operate special event station W2XMN and W2XEA, 13-14 December 2008, from 1400 to 2200 Zulu, to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the invention of FM radio by Major Edwin H. Armstrong in 1933. Try to pick them up, if you will, as well, folks. As I continue scanning through the magazine, there are several other interesting articles, amateur satellites, one headed here, View AMSAT and ARIS presentations on the web by author Terry Douts and 8KI. Another piece in the Morse code category, a basic CW operating manual compiled by Dan Stegner, KB0OBU, from the FIST CW Club member tips. That one's quite extensive, and it would be really good for use in training oneself or helping to train someone else in amateur radio to continue the great tradition of sending Morse code, or CW, as we call it. That's on page 40 and 41. And the QRP section. QRP is the Q sign for low power transmissions, usually 5 watts or less. Christmas Past, A Sudden Surprise for the Season, by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Let's see a little bit about what Richard says. We're running out of time. About this time a couple of years ago, a small box arrived at KI6SN from renowned QRP-er Doug Hendricks. His call is KI6DS. Inside was a plastic bag of parts and an enclosure. Merry Christmas from Hendricks QRP Kits, a letter said, headlined, the G5RJV Polyvericon Tune Sudden Receiver. What a nice holiday gift, and just one of the many, many surprises KI-60S has sprung on the QRP community. Turns out he had given a bunch of sudden receiver packets to all of my friends who faithfully come to the NorCal meeting every month. Since all of us like to build, I decided a kit was the way to go. That's a quote. Although it was never offered by Hendrick QRP as a kit, nor is it now, the Sudden is a simple direct conversion receiver that just about anyone can gather parts for and build. Designed by the Reverend George Dobbs, G3RJV, of famed QRP building design and founder of the QRP Club of Great Britain, the circuit first appeared in a 1989 edition of the organization's magazine, Sprat, S-P-R-A-T. Reverend Dobbs and Mr. Hendricks had kindly given permission for us to reproduce the schematic and documentation for the Christmas Sudden on the KI6SN internet site, the QRPer, at www.theqrper.blogspot.com. Like its older cousin, the Neophyte, featured in the February 1988 edition of QST, the Sudden is an NE602, also known as the NE612, double balanced mixed bass direct conversion receiver for 40 meters with a stage of audio amplification using an LM386 chip. A distinctive advantage the Sudden has over the Neophyte is that often hard-to-find Toco-style coil capacitor IF cans are not needed. All parts are relatively common and quite inexpensive. The original Sudden design has enjoyed several modifications over the years, and the Hendricks version is no exception. KI60S's Sudden featured tuning using an inexpensive polyvaricon capacitor. It's in a plastic housing and resembles the kind you'll see in lots of AM/FM transistor radios. Now, folks, the article goes on and on describing all the different ramifications and pieces of equipment necessary. And it's an interesting little project for people who know a little bit about putting kits together and such as things as that. So check it out. Read the article in World Radio December 2008 on page 4243. And as I turn to the very last page, it says, India amateur radio leader says radio should be taught in school. The chairman of India's Gujarat Institute of Amateur Radio says that the government should incorporate radio communication as an optional subject in schools and colleges. S.K. Nadda, whom QRZ.com lists as amateur call VU3BVD, says that having radio as a subject in educational institutions will help develop people's interest in amateur radio. This, he says, should result in more people joining the hobby, which will result in more operations in the amateur radio spectrum and better connectivity. Nanda, who is also the principal secretary of the group, made the comment while addressing a gathering of amateur radio operators in the city of Gandhinagar. This little tidbit came by way of Yahoo News through AR Newsline. Well, folks, this is your reader, Bob Zeta. My amateur call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. It's been my pleasure to be reading World Radio Magazine and, of course, QSD Magazine and, of late, CQ Magazine for the Courage Handy Hemp System, other reading networks as well. And it's been a great experience to find all the interest that there is in the hobby of amateur radio. Myself, I've been licensed about 26 years, I believe, now. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, near New Bedford, the fishing capital of the world, right near Buzzards Bay and the islands of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. You know, if any of you wonder how this stuff gets put on the air or on the internet, for instance, the Courage Handy Ham website, I actually recorded at home on my computer using a beautiful recording program. And then I MP3 it in a format to the Courage system or to the reading services or wherever the work is intended to go. And in just a matter of a few moments, the whole hour, rough hour anyway, we're at 59 right now, goes through the internet connection and they work it up into their different formats for you to enjoy. I thank you very much for being patient with me. If you care to contact me for any reason whatsoever, any constructive comment is always accepted. My email is n1blf@comcast.net. I wish all of you a very, very Merry Christmas and a better New Year. It's been a devastating year so far for the American public and a lot of people around the world as well. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams can be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email handyham@cards.org. The website is www.handyham.org. 73.